bit many things to say, so that's a little bit of a problem. So I think I'll be rather short here, but still, of course, let me take the opportunity very fast to introduce dynamical triangulations in this format which is CPT to you. To those of you who are not, one can read on their laptops about the news in BBC or so this is done in collaboration with these people with so lattice is gravity. So here I talk about dynamical triangulations. What does lattice gravity offer to you? Well, it offers a number of definition of quantum gravity, whether it's really a theory of quantum gravity that remains to be shown, of course. But using the standard quantum field theory via the passing supervision, essentially it's background independent. And it's nice to say that the passing supervision which is formulated directly as a sum of geometries. So potentially we don't want to deal with diffeomorphism invariants and so on, but they're just summing our geometries. If you want to introduce coordinates again and get rid of them by diffeomorphism invariants, you can of course try to do that, but that's not something that we like to do. So that's good. Let me just list the virtues and the drawback of dynamical triangulation. So you see here, down here, they have dt for dynamical triangulation, cdt for quantum dynamical triangulation. So this was the old thing that we did long ago. It was an attempt to formulate completing quantum gravity. And well, the virtue is you have a nice realization of the Einstein-Hilbert action on these piecewise linear geometries. They do not need coordinates, so that's nice. We have a cutoff, which we claim is geometric, diffeomorphic invariant. A drawback is that the formulation is inherently Euclidean. So what is Euclidean quantum gravity? Action is all bounded from below, and you have to think twice in order to make sense of it. But of course, having a suitable cutoff, you cut off this unboundedness too. But whether it really gives something, it's up to you to prove, of course. Well, but it is a virtue that this cutoff that we introduce automatically acts as a regularization of the unboundedness. Now, a drawback here is that gravity becomes emergent. Well, that's of course very popular nowadays. but in a certain way, I've used it in relativistic science, but maybe also still, as a kind of drawback in the sense that you don't really then understand. Well, you have to work harder at least to understand why does classical gravity come out as some limit of this. Because it becomes now a subtle interplay between the quantum measure and the action used. A virtue is that if you go down in dimensions to two dimensions, where gravity is a renormalizable theory, actually this formalism works beautifully. I mean, it really gives, you can solve this analytically. Kniesnik's protocol, some logical, did it, Francois did it. It can be solved analytically. And this method of introducing a lattice, it actually works. It reproduces the theory, and you can even calculate many other objects that you cannot, are very difficult to calculate in the continuum, can be calculated. But the main drawback of the dynamical triangulations when going to higher than two dimensions is that we never found any interesting infrared limit where we could say, look, this looks like what we would like to think about as a serial gravity. And that led us to change the slightly direction to limit the configurations that we want to sum over in the venture from dynamical triangulation to causal dynamical triangulation. So it has virtues again. That one virtue may, you can debate it, but I think it's a virtue that the passing supervision starts out as a sum over Lorentzian geometry. This is really what we want to do in the world. A drawback, of course, if you want to recover ordinary Lorentz invariant gravity in the limit, is of course that it assumes a time foliation, exactly like Fouchard's theory. So depending on your taste, it's very exciting or it's a drawback. When we formulated it, we viewed it as a drawback, but now, I don't know, maybe it's good. Well, it adds something, if you want to reproduce ordinary and Lorentz invariant gravity in the limit, of course, it adds to your tasks. So, a virtue here, in practical sense, is that actually this regularization is such that each configuration individually can be rotated to a Euclidean geometry by performing what is morally like a time rotation. And one can then use numerical measures. I will not discuss, or I talked about this in the morning, I will not discuss it here. The main virtue now is that seemingly we have found an interesting infrared limit, where it's really quantum gravity, or general relativity in that limit, of course, should be proven, but I mean, the simplest tests are encouraging. And the main questions here are, of course, well, that was why we started out this problem. It was not to find general relativity in the infrared limit, but that was to find a theory which was also rather complete. And so, I mean, of course, it's flawed, but other sources of properties. So that's not answered yet, whether we've done that. I discussed it in the morning with the perspective of actually of asymptotic safety and assuming that what you would see in the ultraviolet limit would be Lorentz-Gran theory.
Yeah. Isn't there another obvious question to ask, which is related to your first point? The fact that there is a preference variation in the system, you know, means that most likely the infrared limit will have this preference variation dependence. And then, you know, then there's a question whether this preference variation dependence disappears in the limit. If not, it cannot be gravity.
Well, that's true. I mean, so this is a drawback, and as I said, it adds, of course, to the checklist of the theory when you finally want to say, is the theory in infrared limit really general relativity? I mean, well, that's
so. What's the evidence that, in some sense, this preference variation disappears? What's the mechanism?
What is the mechanism
that you expect to
happen? Well, the only thing I can say, as I said in the morning, is that when you look at the computer, we see that you can you simply get S4 out as a background, and
you get that in Ricci flow, like very smooth spanning.
Well, I'm saying that. Yeah, sure. Well, of course, many things have to be tuned, but again, GR so what is GR in a covariant, well, in a coordinate independent formulation? Of course, what you should do is that you should come up with observables, because this formulation is in principle strictly coordinate independent. So you should come up with, and this was also what I said in the morning, you should come up with coordinate independent observables. You tell me how they behave in GR, and I go and check it here to the extent that I can do. That's of course what I agree with you that it's definitely, it should be improved. So,
I have a comment on this. I think it's a valid question, but it's just like in lattice gauge theory, right? You ask, what's the mechanism for eliminating the artifacts of the lattice, and it's universality. And long distance, if you're lucky, the system treats all these violations of your desired symmetries as relevant informations in the infrared. So it's a dynamical question whether or not here you restore the full independence of the foliation, just like in the agnostic gauge theory, you restore the full independence of the underlying rotation violations by the lattice.
Yeah, well, I guess you know, there's a key difference is that we know that there's universality for global symmetry, but there's no yet any mechanism for universality for gauge symmetry.
Yeah, but
that's the whole point.
But what gauge symmetry are you talking about? If you formulate the theory, it
drives the time of parameterization.
It's
the question of the residual global symmetry in the infrared. Either it's Lorentz invariant or it's not. And that's a global symmetry. That's not a gauge symmetry.
No, it's a gauge symmetry. Otherwise, you have these propagating modes, these extra scalar modes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
that's
this is the rule.
So lattice gravity here. So the basic tool is the Parsons rule, and of course here's a textbook example of the Parsons rule in non-relativistic particles in one dimension. And so the individual pass here has a decomposition as the average of the pass and fluctuations. And you want the population depends on H bar and the copy constant of the zero here, the harmonic oscillator. Actually, this is a real Monte Carlo simulation. So it's real data. Of course, in quantum gravity, we are dreaming of maybe something similar that we get the average geometry coming out. That's the one we observe in the world. And we have quantum fluctuations of the order H bar. And the transition amplitude now is, of course, a sum of all possible trajectories. But so if you rotate, but in the Lorentzian, there's a phase factor. But if you rotate to a Cruton space, it becomes just a statistical sum. And so here, of course, you have a discretized lattice spacing A of the time. So this is, in fact, piecewise linear, exactly. So, and you have a continuum limit when A goes to zero. You get your propagator propagating from X to Y in time T. Yeah, that's given by this way, this is a classical action. So what we wanted to imitate is the same construction in quantum gravity. And it's a little bit of a weird object, but it's in principle a valid object. That, so you start out with a certain spatial geometry, and you have an initial spatial geometry, you have an exit spatial geometry, and you have proper time T separating them. So it's a very special configuration in the sense that you insist that at any point here in this geometry is separating exactly this time from this. So, but nobody prevents you from studying this amplitude. There are many other amplitudes you would like to study in quantum gravity, but nobody. It's a kind of generalization which involves proper time of the Hartle-Hawking kind of wave function. And of course, our inspiration to study exactly this one came from 2D quantum gravity, where you can calculate this thing analytically in the beautiful work of Kawai and collaborators. They showed how to calculate this as a function of proper time, basically using the formalism of dynamical truncation. So that was, of course, our inspiration. So to define this, you need, of course, a geometric cutoff and a definition of the class of geometries which actually end up. So coming from Denmark, of course, I know exactly what a building block looks like and what you can use it to. So this is what Hawkins in Denmark builds in our phase of five. But still, it looks interesting in general relativity after that, because they started at a university. So the building blocks here in two dimensions are triangles, tetrahedra, and four dimensions, four simplices. Something like this. And we then have this foliation where we fill out space with all kinds of triangulation. So we fix the topology. So the topology of each spatial slice is fixed. And for simplicity, the indication should be S3. But then we could do anything we like. But compact, we stick to compact geometry because we don't really know how to treat the other things on the computer. And then, so we have an arbitrary 3D triangulation here of tetrahedra, arbitrary 3D up here. And then we connect them in all possible ways. Compatible with the topology, such that if you slice it in the middle, it still has a topology of S3. So here's an example of a spatial tetrahedron and four-dimensional synthesis connecting to the other times. So we have this. So we pretend that this is a proper time slicing. Strictly speaking, these two slices built in this way are not separated an exact proper time, say one here, but it fluctuates between some boundaries. So we don't allow in this time slicing. We assume that there is such a global foliation that it doesn't split up like this. And the weak motivation for this is coming from starting from Lorentzian and insisting that the manifolds are adabolic with a verified Lie constructor everywhere, in this time order. So now we dream of this rather weird object here. Defined this way, some of these geometries exist. So we have one boundary here and another boundary here, and we have a three geometry here, that is a three dimensional triangulation here, and a three dimensional triangulation here. We keep these fixed, and we insist that the geodesic distance, or the proper time between these, is t, a fixed number of steps. And then we take the lattice spacing to zero of these building blocks, and we hope that we have a continuum limit. Of course, as long as we keep an eye here, we can do very little. So we make a rotation to Euclidean models. So what is the relation of this setup to the Foucault model? Well, of course, the setup is, as, at least in a weak way, precisely as in the Foucault model. I mean, we have this foliation, and we basically want to sum over geometry. So in addition, as Peter already said, if you measure the spectral dimension in these spaces, so we measure it in KTDC, we got some curve like this, which were a little bit surprising for us because we had done a lot of measuring of special dimension in all the other gravity models in 2D and also in 4D that we have seen. And whenever we measured the special dimension, we basically always saw a straight line, which told us that really the structure of space was self-similar at all scales, down to the very shadow. But here, it was seemingly different. I mean, so there was some curve like this, which we never seen before, and being very naive, we just, if you fit it, you took a, take a two-parameter fit to this curve here, you can get this to go to four, when x, so x is the time of diffusion, so we have a diffusion on this manifold. And the spectral dimension is measured by the return probability of this diffusion process. Then it goes to four for what we call long times or long probing long distances. For short distances, it goes to two, saying that there is something anisotropic, maybe of space and time at short distances. And so for us, it was difficult to understand. Of course, as Peter showed in his model, it, such a curve has a natural interpretation. So it gives a little feeling that, well, maybe these models are not unrelated. But the actions of the two models were seemingly unrelated and still are kind of seen unrelated. So when you put in an act, so what comes to your mind as a natural action? Well, this one, obviously. But it's actually very simple. So the only thing you should pay attention to here is this red thing here that we, so we put in a, the links in the time direction is some constant times the link in the space direction. So we put in by hand a little symmetry there because anyway we had broken the symmetry between space and time, so why not put a parameter in so that we can even control this in some way. And then this is just a red reaction. So it can be simplified to a form like this. So in the enforced here are just the various kinds of building blocks. So if you go back to this picture here, you see there are basically two ways. If you have a tetrahedron here, there are two ways you can, then you can connect it like this to a point here. But if you take, if you only have a triangle, so this triangulation consists of tetrahedrons, but there are of course triangles also, and you can make another tetrahedron by connecting this triangle to a link here. So there are these two building blocks that you can feed up going from one time step to another. So they have slightly different four volumes, but probably not important. So we have this general action here. And you should only take this at this level, I would say, you should only take this as an action which has some similarity to the Einstein action. Of course, it's built exactly from the Einstein-Hilbert action on these discretized lattices, but I think one shouldn't take it very seriously, this Einstein-Hilbert action. It's kind of single on these piecewise linear manifolds. It's like trying to define a derivative on a fractal path, and well, you can do it, but there's a huge room for this. So in this notation here, delta is related to this alpha here. So you can calculate it in some function of this, a symmetry parameter, but it doesn't matter what for us. We just, delta equal to zero corresponds to a symmetric lattice, AT equal to AS, and this alpha parameter equal to one, so the spatial direction C. So in the computer simulations, we keep this term fixed here, basically. So we keep the four volume fixed for computer technical reasons. So we have basically two coupling constants, this is a symmetry factor, and kappa naught, which is the inverse spare gravitational coupling constant, according to this red curve. So what do we see? I apologize, I have already shown this phase diagram, but now let me comment on it. Well, on the perspective of Hochschild gravity and what Peter told us about the Kalmitzian space diagram. So up here is the cosmological constant, here is the symmetry parameter and kappa naught. So really we are fixing this to the critical surface, so we have really a kind of two-dimensional phase diagram, which is this surface here. And what we see is three distinct phases. I call them A, B, and C. So do we see an asymmetry between space and time, like in the Java model, appearing here? So let us see what the configurations look like. So in phase A, we don't see anything which looks very much like we want to see four-dimensional space-time. In fact, we see things are chopped up in small pieces So what I see, what is here is the time direction, and this is this three volume, the spatial three volume plotted at a given time, in this time foliation. So each time slice has a three volume, and I'm just plotting it here as it comes out from the computer at a given computer time. So this is just one configuration. Now, these dominate in phase A, which corresponds to taking the bare gravitation copy constant to zero. So remember that this appears as 1 over g naught in front of the Einstein action. So it forces the Euclidean actions to dominate over whatever entropy factors of configurations that you could have. And my interpretation is that what you see here is exactly the conformal factor. It comes from the wrong sign. In principle, it can be arbitrary negative in the continuum because it comes from the wrong sign. How does it do this? It have rapid fluctuations. Here, of course, these are cut off by the lattice spacing as a limit to how rapid they can fluctuate. But the system is doing its best to fluctuate like this. And this is precisely what we see here. When we go to phase B, where we change the asymmetry theorem, then you see at a certain point that space kind of time collapses. So here, since the total four volume in terms of tetrahedra or four simplices is constant, then it all has to be in the space direction here, so we see something like this. But really, what you see here is not, well, depending on your taste, it is really not like this feature here. So this feature from this point of view is absolutely misleading. And that will play an important role in my thinking here. Because if you look at this three-dimensional universe here, it turns out it, of course, built out of many, many, many tetrahedra glued together. But space here is not homogeneous. In fact, the configuration is more or less like this, if you draw it in a lower dimension, that you have a vertex of extremely high order, and so this, many, many triangles are glued, there can be two of these sometimes, so for example, many, many triangles are glued to this, so you can basically get from any point here to any other point in a few steps. So the spatial extension of this is also zero almost. So this is a universe which has no extension. Although it looks like it has extension here, in fact, if you measure it in geodesic distances, it has no extension. And so in phase C, this is not right. There we both have an extension in time, and we have an extension in space direction, and they scale canonically function of the four volume as you would expect. So here is the two-dimensional phase diagram as a function.
So can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Which of these would refer to the renormalizable case interest model?
Renormalizable case?
Yeah. And you have the high energy regime where it's...
Well, I'll come to how it relates to Peter's thing. So, in principle, we hope, there are really hope, I suppose, that this was renormalizable and there is a non-trivial as well as fixed form that makes sense. But so here is the phase diagram again with these lines, and you might recall kind of Peter's phase diagram. So let me draw it for you again. So he had phase, I'm drawing it exactly the same way as there. So here he had, this was all in space. So here he had that such a term was dominating, and it has an oscillating behavior. That's exactly the phase A, which is over here, where the configurations, they kind of look like that. So it's exactly the same. So now we have these two phases. Yeah? So this was what we call phase C, and which was what we call phase B. So Peter, he had, I don't know what is the best analogy, but here, let's say phi was different from zero, and here, phi was equal to zero. Now, so what is the analogy here? Well, here, the expectation value of g mu nu in some way, like, of course, g mu nu is something that is strange to take the expectation value of in theory, but the geometry is different from zero. And here, space and time has no extension. So really, g mu nu is equal to zero. This would be the analogy, very, very.
So that could be like a phase of topological gravity?
Well, you could think about that. In fact, that was, in fact, well, you see, in the Euclidean only model, we only had this phase and this phase here. And originally what we were hoping for, but unfortunately that phase is still very sad for me, but it seems that due to that. So we really thought that this phase was very interesting in the sense that it was topological gravity, it was a strong coupling of gravity. And then when we moved towards here, there was a phase transition, and so here the Hausdorff dimension is infinite. Here the Hausdorff dimension was 2, it was something, it was this conformal factor dominating and perverse configuration, but exactly at the phase transition, well, if you look at the computer, and you make the Hausdorff dimension 2 here, and 2 here, infinite here, then, well, you know experimental physicists, it's a know what to make, what to look for, and they find it, you know. So we found, of course, that the Hausdorff dimension here was very close to 4. Huh? So there was a transition here between a topological phase and also some degenerate phase, but right here, there was a compromise between the measure and the conforming factor, which made the theory well defined. Unfortunately, it failed because this transition was first order, so we couldn't use it twice. But now, in CDT, because we are constraining the configuration, we simply have a phase here, exactly here, where the geometry is extended and real. So there is indeed, as Peter said, a very close analogy between these things. Whether it's really the same, we don't really know. So this was the first order transition. Then we go to the second order transition. So I will not. I discussed in the morning the computer evidence that you have a second order transition here, or we hope we haven't proven it yet. We hope this is the second order transition. And this is the first order transition. So let me concentrate on this line here, because that's the most interesting one for ultraviolet.
How much of that line have you mapped there?
I'm sorry?
How much of that line have you mapped there? I see the two X's.
Okay. So the dotted line, it means that we have performed computer simulations for small systems and localized this line approximately, and these two are high precision measurements.
All right.
So that's what it means. So, but it's quite painful to find these lines because, so let us jump immediately, but I don't want to spend too much of your time here. It's late. Let us go exactly to this transition BC, which could be second order transition. So, well, the verdict is still up, I should say, but I personally think that it might be a second order transition. So now, can it serve as a Hochschild-Lipschitz ultraviolet completion of quantum gravity? So first, I thought no. So when Peter first discussed this model, I was kind of misled to think that it was not possible, unfortunately, in our model. But now I changed my opinion. and I'll tell you why. So we have, of course. So what Peter tells us is that there is an asymmetry between space and time. You know, so the three volume scale in this way, so it has the same dimension as time, in fact. So if you formulate in terms of distances here, and these are kind of discretized, if you discretize this, then it can be written in the following way. That dt over dr scales like this. Now, what do we see on the computer? Well, you see, I also showed you in the morning these distributions. So when we are in this phase C, when we are in here, in this machine here, we see that time has the canonical extension compared to the four volume, and space has the canonical dimension compared to. So there's no anomalous scaling between time and space here. And this solution was the mini superspace kind of solution. You could be mapped to that. And that was what we took as the weak evidence that this had anything to do with infrared limit or kind of gravity. But I think it's quite surprising. So the scenario one here is that the dimension of space is actually 3. So delta r cubed is equal to n3, or proportional to n3. Now, so when we are in phase C, kind of away from the BC line, then we know that delta t scales in the following way. That was what I just showed to you. But this parameter s depends on the asymmetry parameter. So when we change that, moving towards the phase transition, in fact, this parameter goes to 0. So if it's a second order transition, it is natural to assume that we can have a scaling here. So this goes to a constant times mu, where this mu is kind of less than or equal to 3, because we see that the space becomes flatter and flatter, the time direction shrinks and shrinks. So clearly this exponent mu, well, it could be still 3, but it's 3 or less than 3. But it means that when we form this ratio here, it goes just to 0. But so with the Hochschild scaling, it should scale like this, and it doesn't. But so that was what I first thought. But then, given the second thought, I can realize that that is probably a completely wrong way of thinking about it. Because, as I told you, when we approach this space here, actually space also shrinks. I mean, in the spatial extension is of course what it is, but in the basic distance, the linear extension of space is completely different. And so let's assume that it has a Hausdorff dimension HD, which could be quite different from 3. Sorry, there should be a delta here. So then one would have a relation like this with delta R here. And now putting in this assumed scaling in terms of N3, we have a relation like this. And well, so there are two critical exponents here, the Hausdorff dimension and the scaling of time. And the Hochschild scaling is satisfied if nu is equal to this. And this is indeed a logical possibility. So mu is less than or equal to 3. So let's just take the trivial situation where it was actually 3. So although this vanished, this delta S vanished, I mean, the exponent still should be viewed as 3. It's a possibility. But the Hausdorff dimension is different. It could be different. So then the Hausdorff dimension would be 9. And that's totally compatible with seeing these very promising. So if this is a signal, so when we are thinking here, the Hausdorff dimension really seems to be infinite. I mean, you cannot measure it on a computer because it's so small. But if this is a signal transition, you expect this to happen gradually, and then the Hausdorff dimension is not necessarily infinite. It could be a finite number is characterized by this signal transition. And 9 is a large number if you measure it. So basically he's saying that N3 goes as the geometric distances are, the radius of this, so the factor of 9. So suppose that you want to measure this, actually. Well, then you take an N3 here, and you see how it grows with R. But it's clear that this is a very large factor, so even if this is 1 million, delta R becomes quite small. So it will be maybe not easy to verify numerically, but it's definitely a logical possibility, and I think maybe you will satisfy. At least all the characteristics there are here for such a relation is to be satisfied. So from this way, it seems that to go back to the space transition line, that actually the continuum lift, that there is this possibility. It was not one we were anticipating or even were hoping for originally, but it seems that there's a. In my opinion, there's a great chance that this is actually what's happening, that the oscillatory limit here at the signal transition is exactly one where where an emergent asymmetry between space and time takes place. So that's basically the message. Of course, we are looking into this right now, but I unfortunately don't have any numerical results. I can.
What is the exact definition of that space transition? What happens at that on that line?
Well, so let us go back here. So what you see at that line is a transition between geometries. So you have an extended geometry, which I'm sure this will look like this, where time and space are related in canonical way. That's on one thing. So this is what you would call four-dimensional space-time. And then it changes to this thing here. And you can define an order parameter if you want. I was talking about this in the morning. It's not so interesting. But there is this transition between this. So this universe, again, it's a universe with no extension. I mean, so it's really Planck scale, if you want to use this word, Planck scale universe. You know. But if the thing about transition, there is a gradual transition. And there is a limiting procedure you can take where you avoid jumping immediately to the Planck scale. But we have well-defined scaling, and this scaling could be exactly the Hochschild scaling. Because, again, as Peter correctly said, I mean, in all these games, what is the guiding principle in these statistical models?
This is universality. So that, there are not so many models. I mean, second order transitions are sparse, you know. So that's what saves the day of this. And so that's why I hope that I don't know, but that's why it could be that it is exactly like that. Even if the action that we have put in superficially has little to do with the action, but it's not, well, it's just the Einstein action we put in, but clearly it's a lattice version of Einstein action, so artificial terms which could, at the transition, make it up for exactly this, this symmetry effect. It's a logical
question. I have a question. Is there any reason to think Hojava, the term that Kepler introduced now, renormalizable terms, but there are irrelevant terms also?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we see those as you get close to that line?
Well, they are there, probably. You have to, this is a discretized action, and you have to expand it in some way. So, I write down, let's take a second order differential equation. I write down many realizations of this second order differential equation. It contains many terms of maybe higher order than A, which would formally kind of vanish when the lattice spacing goes to zero. But if the lattice spacing goes to zero in a very specific way, it's not clear that they will vanish. They might play the role of higher derivative terms in the specific continuum limit, let's say, which is kind of non, it is not the simple, I mean, this is true for all phase transitions, I think.
If I can comment on that also, it could also be that this two-dimensional plane is a good approximation to the critical surface of the tricritical point. So there might be two relevant deformations that you can take away from the tricritical point, and it just happens that for the theory with this detail balance, there are two relevant deformations. So this entire plane could be But as you go, for example, into the order phase, and of course that corresponds to turning on the relevant deformations that follow you to z equal to 1 in the infrared, that's why you see a microscopic universe. So that actually brings me to the question, is it possible that the line, the second order phase transition line, assuming it's second order, would it describe z equal to 2 scaling?
It's absolutely not possible. We have not determined the exponents. I put in z equal to 3, but the z equal to 2 would just give a different relation between this mu and the Hausdorff dimension.
Right.
And it has to be determined experimentally.
So it could be that line is equal to 2, and only when you get to the tricritical point,
it's a logical possibility that the exponent. So there are two. So it stops here, actually, the line. And there, so that these two points are special. And exactly these two points set the chair. That would be natural from a statistical mechanics point of view. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's basically the message. So I promise to make it short. That's basically the message. So the setup, let me just summarize, the setup of the global time convolution is coming to CPT and Charlie-Lewis gravity. The spectral dimension measured in the de Sitter space of this thing, the extended space, varies from 4 at long distances to 2 at short distances, and this is similar to what was found in these models. And hinting that the two theories might have the same ultraviolet completion. So I have argued here that Hojava scaling is a possibility along this line, and as we have just discussed, many things could happen there, you still don't know, but we are looking into it. I should also say that CDT, of course, is in principle ideally suited to study a lattice version of the gravity. Should it be wanted? It's not so clear that one wants to do it, but could one find that suitable a discretized action? In principle, one has now the computer program just to put it in. And it's easy to simulate in the sense that these computer simulations are easy. The computer is doing the work for us, but after that, we have to do all the work by collecting the data and analyzing them. So I think that's a good point to stop. We are all exhausted. I'm exhausted. Thank you for your attention.
Well, one question. You looked at the spectral dimension. I'm just wondering, there are other ways of capturing the dimension.
Yeah.
Have you also looked at them, and do they yield the same dimension, or should they yield the same dimension?
Well, first of all, a priori, there's absolutely no reason this would give the same answer. I mean, if things are kind of fractal at some distance, I mean, then the spectral dimension is not equal to, say, the Hausdorff dimension in general. So there's no reason that the dimension would be the same. So we had measured the Hausdorff dimension of these four-dimensional calculations. So that seems to be four. So that's what is that coincides nicely with the spectral dimension at enlarged distance. So for this this Hausdorff dimension, we didn't see this thing going to two. So there we got kind of four everywhere. So we didn't see any convincing change in the Hausdorff dimension, but spectral dimension. But again, if the structure is fractal at these distances, there is no reason that this should agree.
I have a question to the phase diagram you've drawn on the blackboard.
Yeah, sure.
Just to make sure the phase below, the one where phi is equal to zero, or the expectation value of the
momentum.
That is the one where you create universe and animated again, where you're
no,
it's so it. Because you didn't say anything about the last phase, because there's three phases, right? Two agree,
yeah.
Or
yeah.
But what is with the expectation value of chi for the other phase?
So it is this one here where well, so as I said, we already discussed in the morning, this is a little bit misleading. So usually they're quite small, these things, and if you extend the time direction, there will be smaller, and they will appear, disappear, and so on. So we viewed it as a realization of this conformal term here. So that will correspond to this space with the space is oscillating.
So all three phases kind of agree with it.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing.
So related to that, sorry, I guess what I'm
trying
to mention, is it the
sitter
or
anti-sitter? It's the sitter. It's Euclidean de Sitter space. Euclidean space. So it's Euclidean. So what you see here, VP claim can be mapped onto S4. This is the Euclidean solution to this. And this is a space I don't know how to study in our computer in Euclidean space, because it would be unbounded.
Do you think there is no Euclidean
anti-de
Sitter space,
or is there? No, there is. Well, you can just write down it. And at the level of the equation of motions, there is,
okay.
Of course. But it's, the solution is unbounded.
You cannot
calculate it. It's a little bit difficult.
I have a question about phase A.
Yes.
This instability of the conformal factor is stabilized by the fact that it's inhomogeneous in time. Isn't that, am I correct? What is happening is that because...
Well,
I'm thinking, maybe I can say...
Well, if you take Euclidean quantum gravity, it is, of course, unbounded from below, exactly because of this factor. So Euclidean quantum gravity, it wants to take advantage, you want to find the minimum, and you want to oscillate as fast as possible.
Yes.
But here, of course, this is cut off by the lattice. I mean, there is a limit to a factor.
I see. Because in Euclidean quantum gravity, then you can think that some higher derivative operator can stabilize that.
Oh, yeah. No, but that's, of course, a possibility. I mean, so if you add a R squared term or so on, that term could...
That is not what is happening here. You don't know. Would be nice to. You can.
Yeah, sure. But then, if I had to ask
you, that would be great.
Then I don't know whether the solution looks oscillating. I only know if I have the conformal factor, it wants to oscillate as fast as possible, and the lattice cuts itself, and then it would look like this. With R squared term, I don't know what it would look like.
That's what we were talking about lunch, that the lattice actually, in some sense, there's a whole collection of higher order terms.
Yeah, yeah, that is.
So it might be that in a certain way you can interpret the lattice stabilizing
Yeah, sure. No, but I agree entirely. And this is, of course, it's a possibility, but I don't know whether...
I mean, if that is true, then we have a way of looking at Lorentzian and Euclidean. I mean, then higher order Euclidean will be this Lorentzian, what you're looking at. Or unless you have to include some higher order term in this Lorentzian, just to map one and the other.
I'm not sure about that, but it's definitely that one possibility is that one can make this interpretation, but I just don't know, of course. But personally, I wouldn't mind if it was right, but okay.
I just want to comment. I don't know, of course, about the Lattice approach, but in the continuum approach, what Alfie was suggesting is exactly what should be happening. We don't really have the analytic solution there, but this hypothetically identify the critical point with the actual Lipschitz point and then start deforming. If I go into the modulating phase, I mentioned that in the last transparency, it's an open question how you precisely understand the modulating phase. But precisely like you are saying, that there are higher order terms that stabilize you, and at the same time you have lower order terms and derivatives which share a modulating profile.
I mean, that is also what we think must happen in the asymptotic safety scenario, where we know that this R squared term is there, and that is probably what is really stabilizing that integral and the vector. So I think that's really the core of the problem.
Okay. But a negative thing here is, of course, that, well, I mean, when you really want it, I mean, if you want to get a continuous interpretation of you want to really yes. say after, and not just a stupid lattice cutoff.
Yes, I know.
And whether that is realized, of course, I don't know.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Can you go back to the slide where you show the scaling, the time scaling versus the space thing? Because I was just confused about one thing. Maybe, like you said, it's late, so maybe I went to sleep at one point.
Let's see. No. Did that disappear? I'm sorry.
No, it
would be somewhere. Yeah. So, what is this one?
Nothing. Isn't it the next one where you were talking about? So when you're saying, well, you know, as we change n, we need to scale time differently from space. Mm-hmm. But then, aren't you just at liberty to scale space? You're just trying to scale it to make it so that it's the city space. So it's not some stretch thing.
Well, so
is there anything physical really about this?
Well, of course, in the phase C, when you were here, I mean, it's just a simple factor that you're scaling time.
Yeah.
But the canonical dependence on the size of the relation between space and time, in terms of number of building blocks, is canonical. You know, the three times that makes it three. Well, but that would not be true in this other scaling. So a non-trivial scaling there is showing you that time really has a different dimension than space. I mean, so this is exactly what happens in fractal structures where you have an isotropic scaling, you know, that you pick up so.
This is actually quite closely related to the two different choices of time coordinates that I was mentioning in the continuum approach. So you can have the x0 time coordinate which scales the same way as your space if you are far away from this place transition. But once you get closer to the point of the place transition, you're essentially tuning the spatial derivative part of the relative security term to zero. So it's no longer natural to scale space and time differently. You have to change the scaling in order to identify the correct anisotropic fixed point. That's the fixed point. One key to the same term that goes like pi dot squared and the term that goes like pi squared to the pi squared on the same footing in the scaling example. And that forces you into an anisotropic scaling process, but only in the vicinity of the phase transition.
But I should say that of course, I mean, before these new models came, and well, maybe still, I mean, we were of course hoping that at the transition line that you still had some consistent way
I still don't understand, despite hearing talks about this many times, what I'm looking at when I see this picture of the De Sitter onion. It's a typical configuration, if I understand, in a Euclideanized path integral, right? So I guess you have your computer every once in a while flashes a picture up on the screen at random, And that would be a typical picture that you see in that case. First of all, is that a right statement?
Yes.
Okay. But then, physically, what does it mean to look at that typical picture? I'm not looking at a Lorentzian vacuum wave functional. I'm not looking at a transition amplitude. I don't know what I'm looking at physically and how how I should think about the meaning of this thing.
Okay.
Is that a fair question?
Well, it's a fair question, but I don't know what to answer. I mean, this is a configuration, and so let's go back to here. So here I have a typical configuration in the classes. So this flashes to me from the computer, this configuration here. So this is what I showed to you.
Yeah.
So now I have another one here, zip, it flashes to me. Now I take the average value of all of these, and I get the expectation value of this x. So this is what I show to you in these curves, the cosine cube. So if x is the spatial volume at time t, then I show to you the expectation value. This goes like cosine cube. With some time extent, with some prefactor, the prefactor scales as n4 to the 3/4, and the time extension scales as n4 to the 1/4. So the relation between time and space is canonical.
And that expectation value has rotational symmetry in the direction towards the time axis, or not?
No, it's a number. It's v3 of t. This figure, maybe this figure is a little bit misleading. So you shouldn't.
Are you just looking at v as a function of t? So you can't test that.
So I didn't want to spend time on this. In the morning when we discussed this, I said the only information here is this curve here. So this gives you the value. So time is here, and the axis here. This is a 3-volume. This round thing is just to give you an idea of an extended universe.
Yeah.
It contains no information. This is just generated by mathematics.
So that's why the base B is misleading, because it shows you this big volume in one slice, so it's like a symbol.
It's also misleading. This is kind of misleading.
Why doesn't it look like S4? You said it's actually S4.
Doesn't look like S4?
Get the last one.
What's S4 look like?
It's quite close to S4.
It's there, but it's
okay,
but you said that you're only measuring the volume, so then you don't really know with the geometry, only the total volume that you're plotting.
Well,
you don't know what is the.
I have measured this. I can measure any geometry you give to me, but I haven't done it because it's a little bit difficult to know what to do with it. But I would always like people to come up with diffeomorphism invariant observables, which I can measure. In fact, that is a disastrous sparse thing, which makes it difficult. But let me just answer your S4 question, maybe. So here, okay. So in what sense is this S4? So here you see this curve here. That is cosine cube here. And what you see here are the real fluctuations of an individual configuration. So that's why an individual configuration doesn't look exactly like cosine cube. So why is cosine cube S4? Why do we associate this with S4? Well, if I now go to the very last transparency, we relate it to S4 because if you take this mini superspace action here, this is just what you get from Einstein gravity by just keeping the scale factor. And you solve this, it has exactly cosine cube as a solution. So cosine cube is S4, when you slice it in time, I mean, the curves are just cosine cube. That's why we call it this form.
This is true if you have spatial homogeneity, but do you assume spatial homogeneity or do you find out spatial homogeneity?
Well,
in your history.
So we can measure, of course, spatial homogeneity. And so it's totally.
No, but when you run the computer, is this something you use the input and assume that you're looking only at spatial homogeneous histories? Or
No.
Can you measure how spatial homogeneous?
I think you're misunderstanding the logic. So we have a set of data.
Yeah.
This gives you cosine cube.
For the total volume. So the question is the dispersion? Is it really spatial homogeneous or not?
So we are measuring this and we notice that it fits exactly to this mini superspace action, which you would get by assuming homogeneity and a substitute. Of course you can, if you want, you can go in at the spatial slice and you can measure whether the universe is homogeneous, whether it is S3.
So that's what I'm asking. Is
we have done that.
So you're claiming they are homogeneous or not? That's what I'm saying.
Well, in the sense that the geometry is S3.
So you're measuring
some
type of dispersion. Like this should be delta.
Dispersion.
So there should be some other observer you're measuring. That,
of course.
That shows up.
So you have a spatial slice.
Yeah.
That's a triangulation of S3.
Yeah.
You go over to tetrahedral. You take a point there, and what you measure is the balls out there to see how they go as a function of the geodesic distance. And they go as not as cosine cubed, but cosine squared, because we are going down from S4 to S3. Well, that's published in the article. So in fact, the homogeneity and isotropy in the spatial directions are natural, because the way it's built up, of course, we are summing all spatial triangulations, just through the balance of S3. But of course, dynamically, they can break down. And that is exactly what seems to happen here. You know, that so up here you have spatial homogeneity and isotropy for the spatial slices, but down here, it breaks down. And what is happening here, it's a competition between, the action, which simply wants to keep, have it to be spatial homogeneous, and the entropy. So the point is that in all these simulations, I mean, the entropy really wants to beat up the things. And that was a disaster in kind of 4D. So going to the building blocks, let me just end, we don't want to stop here. But let me end with the following kind of remark, something that the Danish kids have learned by building the Lego. So they learn that when they build the Lego and they continue building these blocks, in general they will create something which is three-dimensional. However, the computer tells us that if we are not in an embedding space, but if we are just abstractly gluing together the Lego blocks, then we create something by probability one, which has absolutely no extension. Really, when you just glue them together randomly, you create something like that. A fact which was actually noted by Francois first, that this was a probability. But it seems to be realized, actually. Okay.
Should we all ask David to know? Okay, let's end. And tomorrow.